This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 30th of October, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. It's been a frantically busy fortnight for the design industry, with fairs in an impossible number of cities. We've been busy picking our way across the ones that interest us the most, and today's show brings you these highlights. First up, we head to the annual star on the agenda that is Dutch Design Week, a fair where concepts for the future from the canny Dutch are unveiled.
It's incredibly fascinating to team up with manufacturers and designers and to see how our future is going to look like. I think that's the role of the designer, to make a statement about that.
We hop on a train down to the Belgian city of Kortrijk for their annual extravaganza, which this year had a welcome makeover.
I don't design for manufacturers as a designer. I don't design for stores. I design for people.
And we finish our trifecta of trade shows in Cologne at Orgatech, the biannual beer moth for office furniture, to get a glimpse of what the future of the workspace might look like.
The main thing about the office is the people, and the people don't change so much. The social needs and the need of communication and the need of sometimes hiding away and sometimes being out there in the open.
More on that shortly. Elsewhere in the show, we delve a little deeper into the pioneering work of a few students at the Design Academy Eindhoven. We find out how the Dutch are attempting to design crime out of their streets. And we sit down with Cypriot designer Michael Anastasiades in Stockholm too. That's all to come on this week's edition of Section D. Once a year, the design industry, leaders, lovers and designers themselves, flock to the Netherlands to attend Dutch Design Week. Now in its 11th year, the pinnacle of the week-long celebration of all things plucky and Dutch is the Dutch Design Awards. The prestigious event takes place in the small factory town of Eindhoven. Previously home to Philips, who once manufactured everything here, from light bulbs to radios and everything in between, this town has since become a hotbed of young design talent. This year's awards ceremony took place just last weekend, and Monocle's Dawn Trump ventured over to find the reason why the Dutch are so successful at innovative design.
I've headed to the largest design event in the Netherlands, Dutch Design Week, to kick off the week-long celebrations of industrial design, fashion and exciting collaborations. The industry has piled into a disused factory for the prestigious Dutch Design Awards. Robert Jan, the director of the awards, explains the different categories and tells me why there is much more to Dutch design than meets the eye.
We've got three main categories: product, communication and spatial design. And we've got some special categories. We've got the best commissioners category, that's over around the corner. We got a lifetime achievement award, and the winner of that is already announced. It is Gerard Unger. And this lifetime achievement award is given to somebody who's really good at his profession, but also who is prepared to share his knowledge with younger people. The Dutch always question, you know, they ask, why do you need a new book? Why do you need a new website? Why? The why question. So they never start a project without the questioning, what do you need? Why do you need it? What you're going to do with it? I noticed there's a trend in Dutch design from, let's say, beautiful to useful. You know, younger people are designing products or services that are relevant, that improve the quality of life.
This year sees the 10th annual Dutch Design Awards, and the state of the economy hasn't left designers unaffected. This has been a drawback for some of the judges, who expect the designers to be leading society, not reflecting it, as Robert explains.
The international jury noticed that they're really enthusiastic about the work. They feel a little bit of the credit crunch of the recession in the work. So it's, well, not pessimistic, but you know, there is something going on and they feel that reflected in the work.
And the winner of the Mini Young Designer Awards is Borre Akkersteen. Yeah!
One designer who has impressed the judges is Bora Akacic, winner of the Mini Young Designer Award.
Today was the selection of the last three candidates, and I won.
Were you surprised to win?
Yes, I think you're always surprised when you really hear it. But I must say, I came to win. I work mostly with textile, and I do innovation in textile. My shows that I had in Paris and in Amsterdam, they were all from the yarn to the show. So it's not that I buy fabric and make my pattern and show it. I really develop new techniques into making the mattress industry coming to life in fashion. And from there, like, they found it, I think, interesting as an innovator.
Bora, a former student at the Eindhoven Academy, tells me why Dutch Design Week is important to him.
So the Dutch Design Week was, from all these years, always something that where we showed our work, underground or within something small. So my roots are here, partly. Even that I don't live here anymore, and I used to live in Paris for the last 3 years, it's still always a coming home. And the Dutch Design Award was really something that the big designers were at, all the people that you look up to and you are amazed by their work. And this during the last years, I met a lot of them and worked with a lot of them together. And now it was the first time that I walked in this afternoon and that they said, like, hey, congratulations, man, cool that you're here. And that was the first time that you're like a sort of the equal.
Though it is not just the award winners who have caused a stir. Dan Rosengard of Studio Rosengard has been showcasing his new design, the Smart Highway. He explains why designers need to be more innovative.
And one of our most recent projects is Smart Highway, in which we are developing with a road manufacturer, Heijmans, sort of Route 66 of the future, to make roads more interactive and more sustainable. Design is most related to products and to consumer, but we say we don't want that. We want to update landscapes in a way, the Dutch landscapes. And that sounds a bit weird and maybe a bit large scale, but it's not, because especially in the Netherlands, we live under sea level. So everything is man-made, is artificial, is natural in a way. So it's incredibly fascinating to team up with manufacturers and designers and to see how our future is going to look like. I think that's the role of the designer, to make a statement about that. I think it's incredibly important to make landscapes which we feel connected with. Yes, and I think it's a bit absurd that we spend indeed billions on roads, but nobody really seems to care how they look like or how they behave. So the moment you make things which are either smart in a way that they warn you when it's slippery, or you can charge your electrical car on it when you're driving, or you just sort of feel more connected to it because it has producing a sustainable energy. It's not about waste or losing money, it's about investing in the future, and that's exactly what we should be doing.
Two key trends this year at the Dutch Design Awards are innovation, as showcased by the Smart Highways project, and the production process. Bora explains.
Yeah, I think the last years there, people realize that it's not about the product only, and sometimes the process to the product is just as interesting, and if we dive into there is a lot more possible. We've been working with that for the last years, as the trend forecasters in Paris and as the magazines and that looked forward in it. But now the big audience and especially the companies understand that that's really important, and that they love to show the process. And that's, yeah, what I did before. I found my show in Paris that more important to make a movie that explains how I made the clothing than the clothing itself. So for me, it was like a 50-50. You show the movie, what was the stop motion animation, and then you show the clothing, and that's one.
So how important is Dutch Design Week on a global stage?
Well, that's difficult. They're reflecting typical the Dutch approach, and the Dutch are, well, we're trying to work together with other countries. And well, I think the Dutch as designers are in the top 10 of global best designers, and I think the exhibition reflects that.
This is an award that celebrates Dutch individuality and forward thinking. And what continues to surprise the rest of the world is the number of high caliber designers who hail from here. It's fair to say that the Netherlands is a small country that consistently punches above its weight in the world of design. For Monocle, in Eindhoven, I'm Dawn Trump.
And Dawn stuck around a little longer in Eindhoven to pick out a few more nuggets of contemporary Dutch design. The Design Academy in Eindhoven is at the heart of Dutch Design Week. Undoubtedly one of the more progressive design schools, each year the Academy produces a crop of young, imaginative, creative problem solvers. This year, the graduation class of 2012 opened their doors to the public. Experimental design played a prominent role, with sustainability as one of the more striking trends. Monocle's Dawn Trump spoke with Giacomo Piova about his project, Farming the Pollution, a service for decontaminating land.
The project is called Farming the Pollution and is basically a field service to decontaminate soil pollution and to transform it into a resource. It's composed by four phases. The first one is analysis. There are here on the left indicator, pH indicator. More acidic is the soil, there is more potential of contamination. So this can give you already like a first indication of the grade of pollution. Then after the analysis in the laboratory are processed, offers some a service to plants, this kind of a species, a specific species to absorb the plants. And after a period of 3 months, these plants already absorb some heavy metals. Afterwards, the plants are shredded in loco and in situ, thanks to this machine, which is a shredder, and then it's composed by also press, which is compressed them in solid blocks. Finally, these blocks are stored as a kind of a future resource. That at the moment, I'm thinking to use this as a kind of material which can be stored, isolated. According with scientists, in the future, like in the future 20 years probably, there will be a technology which can help to really process these materials and extract the metals out of it. There is like a kind of gap between design and science, but I think like there is many opportunity to connect these two fields, and that's what I would like to do in the future. Together with that, I'm looking also for other contaminated place and create a real garden. I think it's really important for design to make it visible what is actually hidden at the moment. For instance, pollution is, everybody is walking nowadays on the city, but pollution is invisible. It's invisible, and designer and like also this project helps people to think about it and to really like not just to bring a solution, but more like to create consciousness.
That was Giacomo Piovan there. Next up, Dawn spoke to Hikaru Imamura about her heat rescue, disaster recovery kit, and her range of novel hospital toys.
I made toys for hospital for children. I made four kinds of examinations, such as X-ray, ECG, CT, and echo. Yeah, with this, children can reduce the fear for strange examinations. This is wooden toy that consists of bears of children and parents and also doctors. Every toy has small, simple devices that gives light or sound. So then children can play with those toys with these small mechanism, and they can get how the examination goes. This one is X-ray, and this one ECG, CT, and echo.
And just show me through these books that accompany the toys.
It just tells about the process of the examinations in very simple way. It's like an introduction of the machines.
And tell me through your other design, which is over here. What are we seeing here?
Another project is a heat rescue disaster recovery, is an emergency set for disaster-stricken areas. So, but my focal point is to provide warmth to refugee people. The main body is an oil drum container. It's used as a container in normal days, as a package of water, and yes, some items that needs for using in refugee camps.
Over here there's instant rice.
Yeah.
And water.
Water, work glove, towel, and tubs, yeah, bucket. But the main point is that the pot can be put in the oil drum completely, and then people can prepare hot water with this big pot. In the disaster area, this oil drum can be transformed into a stove. The people's reaction. I got some messages from people who's especially interested in those social subjects, and they are just encouraging me to continue this project and wishing to for me to produce this project in the future.
That was Hikaru Imamura there. And finally, Dawn moved on to Roy Verbakel, who has developed a special brain pen with which he's drawing attention to the thinking hand, as he calls it, the idea that a thought process develops alongside the physical act of writing.
This research is about brain research and embodied cognition, and I use these researches to design these three pens. One is very flexible, and it makes you, it's about doodling. With doodling you remember 29% more, and it makes you more playful. It looks like a sort of antenna. It's quite long, it's 65 centimeters, and it's from rubber, green rubber, with a very flexible part in it, so you're really, your handwriting is really transformed by the pen. For me, it's quite easy to write with it, but it makes you, your handwriting is going to be different, and you have to concentrate more on it. It's not, the main function is not really writing anymore, but really about playing with the pen, using it as a tool for your brain to concentrate behind your computer or wherever. The second is a pen. It looks like a Majorette stick. It's black and it's for balance. And you can also write with that one, of course. And the third one is a clicking pen, because a lot of people are clicking with their pens, and clicking with your pen is quite irritating for everybody around you. So I made a clicking pen that doesn't make any sound, or really a small sound. And this clicking is really good for your, it makes you, the stress go away. It's a sort of stress relief system. So that's the whole idea about it. I think now with a new arrival of the computer, people are using less and less their pens. So I think the pen, you have to redesign it, you have to give it a new main function, because a lot of people play with their pens and they bite on it, they click with it. So it becomes more a sort of brain tool for your concentration and for your stress relief. And at the same time, you can still write, of course, and you can draw with it, because what I already said about doodling. So it still has all the qualities of a pen, but at the same time it becomes a new main function. I think it's really nice to write with your pen, because if you're writing with your pen, you're not sitting behind that computer screen, and it makes your brain also, you think different. If you're designing something on a computer, your design is going to be different than if you design it by hand. And it's the same thing with writing. You think in a complete different way, and I think that's a very important point of a pen.
That was Roy Verbakel, graduate at the Design Academy Eindhoven, with Dawn Trump there. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. We'll be skipping over to Kortrijk in Belgium after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D. Now, a short hop from Eindhoven, the Belgian town of Kortrijk scooped up the design industry for its biannual design fair, Interior. An ever-expanding glut of brands from around the world descended on the town, and our own associate editor, Nelly Gochiva, edged her way in to bring us this report.
I was born here in Kortrijk, so that explains a bit the link. And as a member of the board, I participate in a program to refresh the Biennale. And basically, as a kind of logical continuation of that, the organization asked me to put in practice that renewal, that change. And for me, it was a nice challenge that fitted well what I'm doing with my studio. So I was happy to have this experience.
There are 300 brands exhibiting here from all over the world. How did you make your selection?
First of all, Inter is very unique in the fact that they do make a selection. There's a selection committee, so all the requests to participate pass through the selection. The focus was on more than before, not bringing just the known, the regular brands, but more focus on bringing new to discover brands so that people that come here, professionals and general public alike, really discover new things. And this is also why you, compared to previous editions, you'll see much more space and also attention dedicated to those new brands, the avant-garde, the young ones, and so forth.
How did you make your selection of brands? What did you go for when making your final pick of exhibitors?
I think my input as curator is two things. Is that first, as a designer, you know very well that what we create is a means to create experiences for people. And so more than before, I want this event to be an experience for who participates, for who visits it. Because I think it has to be right context to present the brands and their values. This is not about having square meters on which you put companies. And that was definitely something I brought. Secondly, I thought, and that you can see reflected in the Future Primitives project rooms, is that I thought it was also good for an event like Interior to question a bit more, not just confirm what is there, but question what are the limits of interior design, also how this has to develop in the future. And this is why, instead of having one guest of honor, we actually invited seven guests to develop seven projects, which are not only designers, but also artists and architects. And that's reflecting more my view on interior, which I see as a kind of multidisciplinary event, rather than just styling objects. It's one of the reasons why we, for example, invited a city like Troika, because they're exploring that edge. And I thought it was very interesting to invite artists like them and bring them in interior field. And I definitely see that exploring the overlaps between different disciplines as something that will be more and more natural.
Can you name some newish Belgium designers that you've been following up lately?
Two names. First of all, Müller van Zeveren. They developed here a project room, and I think they did just an amazing project. They are both artists, they're a couple. They're artists and started only very recently to explore also furniture design. And I think you will hear much more from them. And I think their project that they did here is definitely something to discover. Also Alain Gilles, who's been named in Belgium this year Designer of the Year. I think he's also a talent more fully within the design field, very attentive to both the aesthetic part, but also the economic interest that are part of the design. I think they're two good examples of what Belgium has to offer.
And following Louis' advice, we stop by the fairly central stand of Alain Gilles, named Belgium Designer of the Year.
Okay, so basically I'm showing the things I've been designing for the last 5 years for different brands. I think it's a great opportunity for once to get the chance to show all my work together and show that there is a connection between all the different pieces, even though they usually end up in separate different collections.
Where does Belgium design stand in contemporary furniture design?
Well, in a way, Belgium design stands everywhere. For one simple reason is that we're a small country, we're very open to the external world, we have like different countries in one country just because we speak different languages. I think Belgium design is usually fairly rational, also in the way it uses the material. It doesn't put too much embellishment around it, it uses the material for the quality it has.
So it's closer to Nordic design in this sense?
Yeah, in a way it is closer to Nordic design, with of course the southern influence, the more lively stuff that you might find, or in France or elsewhere, yeah.
And one more interesting thing about the fair here, it is also open to general public. So it's actually open to your end consumers. How important is this connection to you as a designer?
Yeah, I'm very happy that it is actually open to the general public. I don't design for manufacturers as a designer. I don't design for stores. I mean, sometimes you're told, yeah, but this is not going to look nice in a store because it goes next to something else. You know, what do I care? I know it's important. I understand the meaning, but I design for people. So I'm happy to be able to show people what is being done, what I'm doing, or what others are doing. And I think that then people go back to the shops because they've learned and they know what they want, and then they ask the shop. So even sometimes if a brand has certain difficulties for some reason, because maybe it's a new brand, they have difficulties getting to the shops, people will come and ask for them. And here in Kortrijk, they've had this long tradition. That's why it's called the Biennale also, and why it's more a bit more like an art fair in a way, and less like a real fair, where you just have commercial buyers. They want to train the public. They want to train the eye of the public. They want to show, they want to select, and they want to show what good design is. Good design is always depending on in which era you're living in, so it always depends on the world that surrounds you. But and I think they've done an extremely good job, because people in the region around here, mainly Flandria basically, and Belgium in general, are not very aware. It's a very mature market. People know exactly what's on the market. They knew the new stuff, they're interested. They almost want to know. They think they have to know. That's part of culture.
And because two design fairs is never enough for 1 week, we rounded off our trip in Cologne. Orgotech is the biannual gathering of the office furniture industry, the biggest event of its kind. It's about more than office chairs, though there's certainly a fair share of them too. At Orgotech, the big players like Vitra and Bene show alongside smaller, younger concept brands. And increasingly, the Chinese are flooding the fairground and market, battling it out with the big guns over price and quality. To find out who's winning, and to get a feel for what the office of the future might look like, our associate business editor, Adrian Craddock, dropped in.
This is the unit that I talked about, where you can actually, you could say, the common unit for your in your office space, where you can get rid of all your waste, and you can also store things that you have in common with other people at the office.
Joachim Lassen loves office furniture. He's the CEO of Montana, a Danish company that specializes in making colorful workplace storage and desks. It's a busy day for Joachim. One of Montana's main showrooms is next to the Cologne Messe, a vast convention space that for the next few days is teeming with people who share his passion. Orgotech is the world's largest office furniture trade fair. It attracts over 600 exhibitors from around the world, all with visions of what will be the office of the future. And Joachim has some predictions of his own.
I see office without paper. I see flexible work desks. I think actually you will keep, there have been a lot of talk about this, that you won't have your own workspace. But I think in almost all organizations, you will keep your own work desk. And I think it's something fundamental in us human beings, that we will like to go back to where we belong. And it's nice to have somewhere where you belong in an organization.
Walking through the stands of large brands like Vitra and Bene, it would seem that Joachim might not be far off. Interestingly though, these big players seem to be putting their faith and money into reinventing a relic of the modern office, the cubicle. But their versions are not the depressing grey cells that we're used to. This is Eckhart Messe, the chief design officer of Vitra.
They're more like organically shaped structures, and that's not everybody's cup of tea. Yeah, so of course, especially in the office world, you have a lot of clients and architects who believe in this, in the grid, in the rectangular grid, but it's always about communication. So the open plan and the possibility to see each other and to exchange information and to grasp information, that's kind of the main thing. But to create a balance, you also need to offer situations where people can retreat where people can be in two or by themselves, and where they can also, by using these situations, like for example the cabin we're in right now, they also give a clear signal to the other people that now they don't want to be disturbed.
Of course, having your employees always hiding away in closed off workspaces is not particularly conducive to an open and social office. That's why many of these big brands are also stepping up their focus on fixtures and designs that encourage chance meetings and idea exchanges. After all, in the electronic age where all you need is a laptop and mobile to do most of your work, it's this function that will keep the office relevant well into the future. Eckhart Messe again.
The main thing about the office is the people, and the people don't change so much. Like the need of the social needs and the need of communication and the need of sometimes hiding away and sometimes being out there in the open. A lot of these things have been around for a very long time.
How have you enjoyed Orgatech so far?
Orgatech is not something which is easy to enjoy. It's quite difficult, boring office furniture atmosphere. It's quite interesting.
That's the voice of Ronan Burlek, one half of the prominent design duo, the Burlek Brothers. Despite his disdain for the fair's commercial atmosphere, some of Burlek's pieces have been amongst the most talked about, including a workplace made out of cork and a line of furniture designed for the University of Copenhagen. For Burlek, the gap between designing for the home and designing for the office is narrowing. And just as it is in a bedroom or kitchen, the key to an appealing office space is balance.
You can have the best vegetables, the best meat, cook them perfectly, but if you put too much salt, at the end it's ruined. I think it's the same for the question of organization, it's the same for the question of design. You can have a marvelous idea, a lot of good material, but if it's if the mayonnaise is not perfectly combined, so these very complex chemical things, if it misses a certain sensuality again, or magic, it's just annoying.
It's advice that many employers are taking seriously. After all, for high-end manufacturers like Swedish lighting company Vestberg, it's about more than just creating a pretty office. It's also about worker efficiency, as CEO Magnus Westberg explains.
If you can just argue that a person is 1% or 2% more efficient working in the right lighting conditions, for example, if you turn that into actually costs, then you can really have a really fast payoff on a product like a light. Mm-hmm. And if you agree that the person could be 1% or 2% more efficient with the right lighting, then there's a good argument in that.
Perhaps the person who is most familiar with the way this sector swivels and changes is 75-year-old Tony Brown. He took over English workspace furniture company Bisley in 1960. Over his time at the head of the company, he's learnt a thing or two about staying relevant and competing with cheap Chinese imports.
You can have the best workforce in the world with dud machinery, they haven't got a hope in hell. You can have the best machine in the world with a dud workforce, you haven't got a hope in hell. But if you actually try and re-equip your factories so they can have the adaptability and the speed and the quality, and you can actually motivate your workforce actually to get up off their asses and do the job, then you've got a first-class setup.
Having seen the way that the industry has developed over these years, you're probably well placed to kind of predict what it's going to look like in the next 50 years, so forth.
I wouldn't have a bloody idea.
Before we move away from the world of the trade fair, time for one last report on an interesting little showcase back in Eindhoven. Safety in the public domain is a crucial challenge in society. Cities are confronted with a wide variety of crime-related issues that affect personal and public well-being, from bicycle thieves and loitering teens to the far more serious threats of terrorism. At this year's Dutch Design Week, the Designing Out Crime research team, in collaboration with the Young Designers Foundation, explored how design interventions can reduce opportunistic crime. Sophie van Hoff, strategic advisor of design and innovation at the City of Eindhoven, explained more about the project.
Designing Out Crime is a method that was developed by Professor Kees Dorst at the Technical University of Eindhoven. And he's doing the same thing in Sydney as well, in Australia. And what is designing our crime? What Professor Dost says is that it's very unwise to enhance safety by adding cameras or by having the police be there more often, because this enhances the feeling of unsafety. So with designers, they try to develop solutions in public space that trigger people to behave in the just way, and that, well, makes crime go away. So we have done a few projects. One of the projects is the Marathon of Eindhoven. There was a very big incident in Duisburg in Germany 2 years ago with all the people on this big festival. There was panic. And with the marathon, we have a lot of crowds in the city center, which is quite unsafe. So we asked designers to look at this problem, and they developed a web application and an app to disperse people on the whole of Eindhoven. So instead of remaining in the center, they are triggered to go and see other places and to spread through the city. So this is this designing our crime project. We are doing the same thing on the moment on Stratens End, which is the big area where a lot of young people go out, but there are a lot of fights at night. And we do not have concrete results yet, but they are doing that on the moment. And the third designing our crime project is with what we call Hangjongen, which is the youth. This is a photo from Australia, from Sydney, because they have done the same project in a similar neighborhood. This is one of the solutions they had to enlighten a very dark road and to make it more lively, and people gathered there and there was more social control. The second one, we do not have the real solutions yet because it's still running, but it's about Hangjongen. Hangjongen is the youth that is annoying people, the big crowds of nasty youngsters. And students now are trying to find solutions to make it more safe and to enhance the feeling of safety with people. And very funny thing that happened is that one of the students talked with those youngsters, and they were kind of surprised that there was this little lady, this very old lady in the neighborhood that was very afraid of them. And they went to her home, and they are doing the shopping for them now. So it's often not a real problem, but it's perception from both parties.
That was Sophie van Hoff, Strategic Advisor of Design and Innovation at the City of Eindhoven, talking to Dawn Trump there. Time for a short break, but stick around. We're off to the very clean city of Stockholm after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly programme on the best in design, architecture, graphics and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology and driving.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Leaving the stuffy stands of the numerous trade fairs behind, we head north now to Stockholm for a breath of fresh air. Cypriot-born, London-based designer Michael Anastasiades was in town recently to plan his new collaboration with one of our most favourite local brands, Svengst 10. He took some time out of the discussion to sit down with our Stockholm correspondent, Elna Nikkanen Andersson.
Well, the collaboration started quite a few years back. I think the first introduction was done during Ilse Crawford's exhibition for Svengst. And again, I believe it was during the Stockholm Furniture Fair at the time, or around the time. And she used quite a lot of my products in her setting. And then eventually after the show, some of the products were kept and sold in the store. And then eventually kept some contact and flirted with the idea of working together. I always wanted to design for Svengst, and I really admired the quality and what Svengst was all about. I mean, it was interesting for me to, because although a company, it was more like an institution for me. It was almost designing for a contemporary museum, and this is why the the challenge was for me to do something specifically for the company. So the perfect opportunity came when Svenksten came to me and asked me to design a similar show, how I see Svenksten now.
And what was it specifically about Svenksten that attracted you?
First, the history. Second, I guess it's Joseph Frank, because I love all the work of Joseph Frank. I've been a big fan of his work. I studied quite a lot of his designs as an architect, as a designer. Also, what was interesting for me was the Vienna period in contrast with the Sweden period, and how different these were. That's what already a very, very strong attractive point to do something with that. And if you look at the pieces of Joseph Frank, they're very interesting for me in the sense that studying these pieces, there's a big contrast in the nature of the design language. I find that the pieces that were designed before Stockholm were quite bold, I would say, and quite masculine. And looking at the pieces that were developed after Sweden here for Svenksten, they're very feminine.
Mm-hmm. And,
Esther's influence. It's probably Astrid Eriksson's influence, or probably both influencing each other and coming up with this new recipe for things that was totally new, totally different, and at the same time very refreshing. So the challenge for me was to understand this contrast, and also to try to relate to that type of work, because the new work was also a contrast to what it was that I produced and designed, but at the same time shared quite a lot of similar values over very much the making of things and the quality of the materials and other values like the longevity of the product, which are quite crucial for my work. So this exhibition came as a negotiation stage between me and Svenksten, and then what it is to follow, I guess, as a collection of products that we're going to produce together.
Mm-hmm. And could you talk a bit about the products that you're launching together?
It's primarily a collection of lamps, because lighting is a very big part of my own business. Also, together with some other furniture pieces, we're designing some tables and some cabinets. Some of these products are going to be launched purely as limited editions for the exhibition itself, and some of them are going to be incorporated in the collection of Svenksten and be sold in larger numbers.
And you talked a little bit about the sort of similar ways of working, you and Svenksten, the sort of detailing and the handicraft that goes into everything. Is that especially important for you?
I believe in quality, and for me this is fundamental in my work. I believe in quality just purely because I believe that you design a product not for a short period of time, but for a very long time. And I'd like to see my products surviving the course of time. And that is very much reflected also in the design language that I use. I mean, if you look at my work, it's quite ambiguous. Some people have a very hard time trying to identify the time that it was actually designed. And I find these as a compliment, not as an insult, because, you know, I get people putting my work, you know, 100 years back, or some people put my work 20 years back, and some people put my work now, and some people might find it still contemporary in the future. And for me, this is the biggest compliment, is to survive that long. So in that way, the similarities with Svenksten is that having all these designs surviving throughout all these years, it is very much about the quality. It is very much about the strength of the pieces themselves. And this is what actually made them last that long.
That was Elna Nikkanen Andersson there with designer Michael Anastasiades in Stockholm. And we can't wait to see the fruits of that exciting collaboration soon. But our final foray into the world of design this week sees us join the merry troupe of travelling fashion folk, Clemens and August. Taking initiative from a small budget but big ambitions, the German company settled on the clever idea of travelling through 10 cities for 3 days each with their collection, instead of setting up permanent retail homes. Monocle's James Pearson caught up with them on the London leg of their journey.
Well, good morning, sir. Let me introduce you to our new collection, the Winter Collection 2012. As every season, we have three types of suits with us. We have our classic suit. We have them in two different colours.
Escaping the rain and the cold, I've come to the 20th Century Theatre in Notting Hill. For 3 days, this elegant space plays host to the touring collection of Clemens and August. I've asked Max, one of the assistants, to pick me some warmer clothes for the colder months ahead.
Let's see, this season, this is one of my favourite pieces. We have the modern cut suit, which comes in a, I even call it Brit check, which is a brownish base colour, but it has turquoise and petrol checks on it. And you might as well just try it on if you tell me your size.
Since it was founded in 2004, Clemens and August has built its own loyal customer base. The brand operates on a tight schedule, with two tours each year, one in October and one in April. And collections like these are invitation only.
Well, with this one, since it's a very loud suit, as I explained earlier, I'd go with a white dress shirt. And since you're a slim type of guy, I would pick the open button one because it gives you a nice fit to it.
Compliments aside, it's not just the suits that are slimmed down. To minimize cost, Clemens has no permanent stores. As I'm having my new outfit selected, its founder, Alex Brenninkmeyer, joins me to explain the brand.
Well, we used to show our collection at the Prêt-à-Porter in Paris during the fashion weeks there. Even being very successful in one of those major cities as a young designer brand, we realized actually that the market is very limited. In London, you have a lot of stores who buy independent young brands. But outside of London, it's actually very, very limited. And the same is in France and Paris. So what we kind of realized is that even you have this kind of effort and investment in Paris, if you don't have the small money to do all the advertising, you don't really get anywhere. Coming up with this new system, we thought of naming it Clemens and August, two brothers who kind of 170 years ago went from one farmer to another and also sold high quality fabrics themselves.
And in an age where digital shopping is growing and growing, do you find your customers really appreciate being able to come to a store, look at the fabrics, the materials, the clothes, and just try them on, sort out, talk to your staff?
Yes, I mean, they find it very rewarding that when they come to us, make the effort, even within those 3 days. We're only here for 3 days in London, and the same, actually at the same time in Berlin right now. Last week we were in Cologne, in Amsterdam, and Zurich at the same time, and the people come there, they actually wait for us, and we're there then only for 3 days. So they make the effort, and they know that they get kind of rewarded with the price. That's really for them a new way of doing their shopping. Normally now, I used to do that myself, is looking at some collections in the stores, and then most of the time waiting for the markdowns to come, and then hoping that your size is still available. So we actually do that right at the beginning of the season.
As well as the method of shopping, the clothing style is also original. Alex's collection this year has a blend of sophistication and sport, mixing business and comfort.
We love to combine kind of a refined combination of classical well-cut suits or well-cut styles with something more casual. So the tailoring, to have that with something sporty, it's kind of an easygoing, but at the same time, sometimes can have quite a luxury image or expression. So sometimes we have, with a men's, for example, we have a sporty jacket, a short jacket, a hood jacket. In this collection, we have also have this kind of combination of, with the ladies, for example, the tuxedo jacket, and then you wear it actually with a wider trouser, with a kind of, a jumpsuit trouser, you call it, I believe. We love to combine different qualities. We obviously have the high qualities mainly coming from Italy. A little bit comes from Switzerland as well. Silk and cashmere qualities, which then combined with wool mixture sometimes. But also having certain cotton qualities, which you would probably not even expect in a high quality fashion collection. we have some customers who love to experiment a little bit with the things we offer them, who work with McKinsey, for example, or they are lawyers and they actually can't walk on the street like that. So what they then choose similar fabrics, but then more in the classical cut.
I get the sense that you came from the fashion industry, the Fashion Week background, and you want to take these styles, these designs, that way of approaching clothes and take it to people all around Europe. Is that what you're about, rather than competing with the big labels?
What I realized is that it's beautiful to have a fashion show, and it goes a lot of effort of the designer goes in that, and you, in order to make a fashion show interesting, you have actually to design a lot of different styles who in the end you and me would probably not wear every day. So there's a huge kind of effort which then in the end is not used. So what we now do is actually focus on collections which we really, each single piece you can actually sell very well. I mean, we do from a jeans, from a casual trouser to very stylish dress or coat or so. So everything you can actually wear, even a tuxedo or an evening dress we produce.
That was Monocle's James Pearson with Alexander Brenninkmeyer of Clemens and August in London. And that brings us to the end of this week's episode of Section D. Next week, we're coming to you from Tokyo, where the design crowd is out in force for the annual Tokyo Designers Week. Be sure to tune in for our own survey of the people, shops, businesses and designers making a splash in Japan right now. This show was produced by Gillian Tobias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. And playing you out in honour of the miles and miles of trade halls stamped this week by our hardy team, here's Nancy Sinatra with These Boots Are Made for Walking. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
You've been a-messin' where you shouldn't have been a-messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.